And I'm reminding you, you're going to see this. Chapter 1 of Revelation is about John on Patmos. 2 and 3 is about the church. And then the future. Now I'm going to give you the outline. And this really is this is the heart of the final exam. So one of the young ladies came up and said, I don't want to miss what's important. I said, okay. I put it in yellow. Okay, so that means it's really important. The worship scene in heaven is Revelation 4 and 5. Okay? Remember, if you want to really learn something, you have to hear it, you have to see it, and you have to say it, and you even have to do tactile response. So the typing is tactile, the hearing right now, the seeing is right there, and the response is, I'll just have you repeat it. So let's read number one, the worship scene in heaven, Revelation 4 through 5:14. Some of you weren't saying it, and you're going to miss it, and you're going to regret deeply at the exam, because Shirley has written the quiz in such a way, or the exam, that if you're not paying attention, they sound similar. So I'm not tricky like that, but she is, okay? So the worship scene in heaven. How many of you know who I'm talking about? Shirley Richards. Some of you, yeah. You should know her. She's the one that gives the grades out. The Great Tribulation on Earth is the core of the book. It goes all the way from 6 to 18. That's where we're starting right now. It's the most fascinating part. It reads better than a horror movie. I mean, it's like God's horror movie, only it's really true. And it's the Great Tribulation on Earth is from chapter 6 through the end of chapter 18. So let's read line 2. The Great Tribulation on Earth, 6 through 18, 24. Very good, you're with me. Now, the climax to the tribulation is the return of the king. Now, a lot of you thought that was a Lord of the Rings movie. No, it's actually true. The king himself is coming. And he's going to come in the clouds, and people are going to be watching on Facebook Live. You know, every eye, it says, every human on earth will see his return. And that's the first 21 verses of chapter 19. Okay, so let's read line 3. The return of the king, and it's chapter 19. Good. Actually, it's the whole chapter, but I just wanted to see if you knew that. Then chapter 20 has two parts. The first part is the millennium. That's the first 10 verses. This is utopia. You're in New York. Did you know a lot of utopian societies were here? And they tried to have utopia on earth, and there's a Mormon settlement. They're buying up all kinds of land in Vermont secretly, and now it's in the papers, and people are fighting it, and they're trying to start a utopian community up there. Utopia is where everything is kind of perfect. Millennium is not in the Bible, that word. That's a Latin word. Mille is the word for 1,000, but it does say 6 times in 10 verses that God is going to do something for 1,000, for 1,000, for 1,000, for 1,000, for 1,000, for 1,000 years. So that's why we call it the millennium. And then it culminates with one of the saddest things in the whole Bible. Jesus himself is ruling the earth for 1,000 years. It's so clear he's ruling. If you read chapter 20 and Isaiah, if you will do what he says, it will rain on your field. It's an agrarian society then. Everybody's living in this perfect world. There are no poisonous spiders, no poisonous snakes. There are hardly any weeds. People live endlessly. It says in the Bible that if you don't do anything bad, you'll live the whole 1,000 years. So there's a whole transformation of the world. And we'll talk about who's going to get in on that. But after living in a nearly perfect world for 1,000 years, do you know what it says in verse 11? The whole world rebels. God has set up a camp. It's 37 and a half miles wide and 37 and a half miles long, which is 1,500, I mean, it's 25,000 cubits by 25,000 cubits. And it's kind of like a visitor center in Jerusalem. That's what the Millennial Temple is, like a visitor center. And the whole world has to come through the visitor center when God invites them for the Feasts of Israel, and they hear about Christ. So it's like an evangelistic. It's kind of like going to Times Square and setting up a booth and letting people come through and hear about Christ. The whole world gets to do that for 1,000 years, and after living in a perfect, weed-free, poison-free, endless, healthy life world, they all say no. And they all organize to try and march on Jerusalem and destroy the temple. And God says, enough is enough. And he incinerates them, literally. And then he resurrects them to stand in front of the great white throne judgment, one by one. And they look up, and they fall to their knees, and they say, I believe. And he says, I know you do. Too late, but you do believe. Everybody in hell is a believer. Of course. Because they're seeing God face to face, but it's too late. While you hear his voice, it says in Hebrews, harden not your heart. You don't get, and I don't get a second chance. When we die and see it's all true, it's too late if you haven't believed while you're alive and breathing. And so they are, verse 15 that you have to memorize, and whoever's name was not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life was cast. Literally, an angel picks him up, walks over to the edge of the platform and goes, and goes back. And the next one has stood in front of God, and they fall on their knees, and God tells them, it says he shows them all their works, all the sins, because if Jesus hasn't taken the punishment, God still has the record of every sin. And so they're going to be condemned, told all their sins in life, and thrown into the fire where they endlessly pay for the sins Jesus perfectly offered payment for. And then after that's part of the Bible, we go to heaven, which is the eternal state. So you need to know 4 and 5 is the worship scene in heaven. The Great Tribulation is 6 through 18. The Return of the King is all of chapter 19. The Millennium is the first two-thirds of chapter 20. Great White Throne is the last third. And heaven, the eternal state, is the last two chapters. Okay? Since I told too many stories about my wife, I'm kind of behind, so I'm going to talk faster because we have to get this done. If you turn in your notes to page 3, there are 7 Beatitudes. Page 4 is a summary of the churches. A lot of this is Dr. Davis's wonderful work that is so good I didn't want to leave it out. The 15 doxologies is the next page. Page 5, the use of numbers. Oh, there's just so much in there. You can look at that. Comparison of Exodus and Revelation. But where you need to be is on page 8. And page 8, now we're into more things you really need to know. The title is, it's the Revelation of Jesus Christ. How many of you have ever waited in line for a concert and wanted to get to the front? Okay. How many of you ever wait in line for an Apple product, like you wanted to get the iPhone, whatever, and you wait? Have you ever seen the pictures of the people camping? How about the premieres of something, you know, like some famous movie? How about the unveiling of the new model of something? That's this word that's the first word of Revelation. It's the unveiling. They used to have in Detroit, I don't know if they have it anymore, but in Detroit, Michigan, every year the big three automakers would bring their prime model and they would have a cover over it and they'd have it on a stage and all these people would be in there and it was for them to pull off the cover of the first Mustang. Like that was a big hit. Lee Iacocca developed that first Mustang. It became Ford's centerpiece, the original Mustang. And everyone was there with their cameras, and they pulled off the tarp, and you could see the car. And everyone gasped and took pictures and were thrilled. The book of Revelation is God pulling the tarp off. There is more teaching about the person and nature of Jesus Christ in the 404 verses of Revelation than anywhere else in the Bible. It's the Comstock lode, if you've ever heard that term. That was a big mine of silver in Nevada in the 1860s. It's the Comstock lode of Christology in the Bible. So it's about him being unveiled. Secondly, I already told you this. Revelation was written by John. He wrote how many books? Okay, good. And he lived in the late 90s, and the emperor was Domitian. You can see that in your notes. The background and setting, you know, he's on Patmos, and you can read all that. The interpretive challenges, you just need to know this. It's not on the test, but you really should know this. You know why? When people hear you're in a class on Revelation, a lot of them will go, like people back home, especially unsaved people, they go, oh, that's a hard-to-understand book. Do you know why? In your notes is why. Christians have come to four ways of looking on the Bible. The preterist means it's a description of what happened with the fall of Jerusalem in the first century. In fact, there's a pastor that pastors in my town that tells his people that Jesus Christ has already, all the events of Matthew 24 that Jesus promised have already taken place. Really? Really? You mean every eye has seen Jesus, and people have hidden from his face, and if he didn't stop it, everyone would die, like it says there? No. He says, but it kind of happened. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of views, the preterist, the historicist view, which means it's kind of a general picture of the future. The idealist, it's just, this is just like it's full of good stories, but we're futurists. So that's all you need to know about that. Now, let's get to page 10. In page 10, and now a bunch of fill in the blanks. In Revelation 6 to 9, 16 and 19, we find living hope for the end of days in the return of the real King Jesus. What's the one thing Jesus told us to do? To watch. We don't know, as believers, when he's going to come. And so when we see him coming in Revelation, it's a reminder for us that we don't know the day or the hour he's going to come for us. We're not waiting for the second coming. We're waiting for him to come and take us home to trigger the events of the tribulation. So watch, you need to fill in. In Revelation 10 to 15, living hope for the end of days is the mystery of Jesus revealed. And you're going to have fun when we walk through that. And just ponder all the lessons. In chapter 10, we see this big angel with one foot on the land and one foot in the sea, and he's eating this scroll. In chapter 11, we see the measurement of a millennial temple, and John is in wonder that there's a temple with something awful next to it. What's the awful thing that's on the Temple Mount now? The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. And it appears from Revelation 11 that they don't destroy that, that the Jews are allowed by the Antichrist to build their temple over here. And the Al-Aqsa is at the end, the southern end. Dome of the Rock is just a little bit off the middle. And the tribulation temple is going to be there. How do I know there's going to be a temple in Jerusalem? Because Jesus saw it. He talks about it. John, the apostle, saw it. Paul, the apostle, saw it. And Daniel, the Old Testament prophet, saw it in their prophetic vision. So I know it's going to be there. Ponder those truths. Revelation 17 is living hope for the end of days in meeting the true bride of Christ. Revelation 17 is about the false, apostate, ungodly church. We'll cover all that. Remember that Jesus is the true one that we are engaged to, not the false apostate church. Revelation 18 is really interesting. It's the destruction of the riches of the world, commercial materialism. And I'll cover that, but just measure your life. Do you know what your true wealth is? Most of you probably aren't very wealthy right now. But do you know what true wealth is? What no one can ever take away from you. Yeah, most people spend, I mean, what's her name? The lady that, Kanye West's wife, Kardashian, or however you pronounce that one. Did you hear what just happened to her? Someone stole her how many million? $11 million worth of what? She doesn't have true riches. True riches are what no one can steal from you. So she's not really rich. Yet we think she's rich. People think, oh, I just wish I had 1 million. No, you don't. I know some very wealthy people. Money does not buy happiness. It just buys ways to look more places for it. But why do you think guys like, what was the Joker guy, Heath Ledger, why do you think he overdosed at the height of his career? Money doesn't buy happiness. The tree of happiness does not grow on a sin-cursed earth. It's only meeting, remember, our origin, our creator, meeting our creator, letting him become your redeemer, and living for him and answering to him is the only way. So we're going to talk about wealth there, but not right now. It's coming. And finally, the end of the Bible, living hope for the end of the days is the mansions Jesus has prepared for us. Mansions, by the way, I want to comment on. Jesus said, I go and prepare a place for you, John 14. 1 through 6. And in the translation of the Bible through the years into English, the word manse was used, which we turned into mansions, kind of like Dolly Parton mansions, you know, these gigantic big white houses, you know, lining the boulevard. That's not what it means. Actually, that word where Jesus is preparing a place for us, that word is the same word in Greek that's in Hebrew, in the ark that's used for the nests of the animals in the ark. It's the very same word that's used. One is, you know, the Hebrew word is translated by that Greek word, so it's amazing correspondence. What God said is, he has one big house, he's the Father, Christ is our brother, and we all have rooms in the house. It's like we're living in the most amazing dorm in the world, next to each other, and going to meals together, and that's what we'll cover. Heaven is amazing. This is really important, okay? And you need to underline and learn this. This comes about four different ways on your quizzes and tests. The theme of Revelation 19:10 is what worship is. God defines worship in Revelation 19. And I'm going to apply it to you. Because I hope your heart will be stirred. Because a lot of you are going to have to make a choice between this. Do you see what I'm holding here? What is this? A digital device. It's, I don't even know whose it is. It's an LG broken digital device. It's somebody's. You are the most amused generation in history. Amuse is a word that comes from the Greek. A is called an alpha privative. It means not. And muse means to think deeply. Amusement means don't think deeply. When you're playing Angry Birds, you do not have to think deeply. When you're playing, you know, Grand Theft Auto, when you're playing role-playing games, you don't really think deeply. You just respond and get into an amusement, an imaginary world. Worship is when God quickens, that's an old-fashioned word for makes alive our conscience by his holiness. Now, before I just said that word, this is a rhetorical question. I'll tell you when I want you to answer out loud or raise your hand. So how many of you today stopped sometime before you got to class and thought about the holiness of God? That is not a big topic for most people, especially 20-somethings. Worship is when we think of his holiness, and he quickens our conscience. What that means is our conscience is the divine ally that lives within us. It's part of the image of God. Your conscience, everyone has one. We were all born with one. Whether you're a Hutu or a Tutsi living in Central Africa, or if you're an Aborigine in Australia, or you're just this big-time American, we all were born with a conscience. Actually, we're born with two candles. Romans 1 says, but I'm not teaching Romans, but Romans 1 says we have the candle of conscience, and that candle is telling us what we're doing. We kind of feel it's not right. You know, like we start lying, and inside we go, oh, you really shouldn't be lying. Everybody has that. It's called your conscience. Or we're starting to exaggerate the story, or we're taking something that's not ours, or we're going into a realm which we might call immoral. Everyone has this little, you shouldn't be doing that. That's your conscience. But what people do, it's like a candle. Your conscience is a little light that shows you the things you shouldn't do. Do you know what most people after a while do with their conscience? They go like this and blow it out. They stifle and silence their conscience. The other little candle we're born with is creation around us. And creation around us, Acts 17 says, we look at the symmetry of the universe, at the complexity of all the flora and fauna. You know, I'm even these mums right here. I mean, how does black or brown dirt and clear water turn into green leaves and yellow? I mean, look at that. This thing has only been fed black dirt and clear water. And maybe a little Miracle-Gro that's green. But look. But this one always comes out that way. And the same brown dirt and clear water makes that one orange. Now, somebody programmed that. And you know what? The seeds from the pumpkins always make pumpkins. Isn't that amazing? There's such order and symmetry right down to the molecular level and the subatomic level, all the way up to the macro, the universe. In fact, just this year, they released the findings from the, they did a super enhancement of one tiny part of the night sky. America paid billions with Europe, and they did a super enhancement of what they thought were about, they thought it was a star field. You can read about it in all the newspapers. It's the most amazing thing. So they super enlarged that square of the sky, and the more they enlarged it with their supercomputers, every individual star they thought was now a galaxy. So it went from being a million stars as they got closer to it with the enhancement of the computer. It looked like a million galaxies. So they kept enhancing it, and they got closer, and the million galaxies turned out to be a million clusters of galaxies. They weren't individual. They were like multiple ones. And what they found is everywhere you go, whether to the furthest reaches of the universe or right down to the molecular and the subatomic world, everything has the same rules. That's why we have laws of physics. They're all governed by the same rules. And that's creation. The Creator's signature is on everything. And you know what people do? They go, they have their two candles. They have their conscience over here, and they have the Creator over here. And they look up and they go, nope, I think I evolved. I think I'm an animal. I can be any kind of animal I want. I'm going to live my own life. And they blow out that candle and throw it away. And they take the whole evolutionary lie thing. And then this candle keeps telling them what they're doing is wrong, and they don't like that. So they go, blow that one out. And then they are past feeling, as Romans says, and you guys have the book of Romans. So what do we do to not become like them? Because if we're around unbelievers, unbelievers corrupt our good behavior. Worship is when we quicken our conscience by looking at God's holiness and saying, Lord, I don't want to walk according to the course of this world. When I was little, I used to go on canoe trips with my church. Canoe trips, they're so much fun. You get in canoes and you splash each other, and you don't even have to paddle. They let you down upstream. Have you ever noticed that? And you float the whole time downstream. You don't do anything. You just sit in the canoe and splash each other and tip everybody over and get back in and everything. Did you know that's what life is like? We were all born into a world that the entire river is going toward hell. And Jesus was standing in the middle of the river, and he stopped our canoe and he says, hey, that's eternal destruction. That's my kingdom that way. And if you will follow me, we have to go upstream. Oh, did you know the first time you start paddling on a canoe trip, you find out it's really hard to go against the current. And everybody in this world, Jesus says, wide is the way and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And everybody is going this way. And here's, the whole world is going this way. And the Lord turns our canoe around. And we start going, bump, bump, bump. Oh, they go, where are you going? You're crazy. What are you doing? We're going that way. What's wrong with you? And we're paddling away. And they try and stop us. They think it's strange, Paul said. Peter said. They think we're crazy because we're not going the same direction as them. But what happens is if you're not paddling, and paddling is the what God calls practical sanctification, denying ungodliness and saying no to sin and repenting and confessing and finding the grace to help in time of need. Those are the paddles. If we're not doing that, as soon as you stop reading the Bible, praying, repenting, confessing, seeking cleansing, you're flowing with the current. And you feel further away from God. Even at Word of Life, you feel cold. You feel distant. You feel awful. And you know what's really neat? No matter how many steps I take away from God, do you know how many steps it is back? One. See, the instant that we confess and forsake, boom, we're right back where we're supposed to be. And all we're supposed to do is start paddling. All that is worship. That's where our conscience is quickened. Secondly, he nourishes our mind with his truth. That's why reading the Bible is so important. Sanctify them by thy truth. Thy word is truth. And so that constant, when I'm reading the Bible, I'm worshiping the Lord. And then he purifies our imagination by his beauty. Do you know what our imagination is? Our imagination is like a screen with a continuous movie going on there. In the book of Ezekiel, God allowed Ezekiel to see inside the minds of the people of Israel. And he had him, it's really a cute story, it's in Ezekiel 8 through 12. He gets down on his knees and the Lord says, dig through that wall. And it was a mud wall. And he digs through it and there are bricks in there and he moves them. And the Lord says, stick your head in there and see what's in there. He says, I'm going to let you see what's on the chamber of the imaginations of the people of Israel. And Ezekiel stuck his head in there and went, ah, and he backs right out. He said it was full of filthy, horrible, wicked stuff. And God says, uh-huh, that's what I'm seeing playing on their minds all day long. Without the Spirit of God's intervention, our imaginations are made up of kind of a collection of everything we've seen and heard and read and glanced at, and those little pop-up ads and little lyrics to songs and all kinds of our own lusts and everything, and it just makes this horrible imagination. Fear, anxiety, despair. There's all this horrible stuff that Satan wants to plant in our minds and we play on our screens. Submission through worshiping God purifies our imaginations as Christ is more beautiful than all that trash over there. That's what worship does. I see him. I'm satisfied by him. And finally, he opens our hearts to his love. We realize that God already treated him like he committed all those sins. And so that when I realize that, it makes me love him more. So this, you're going to see this every possible direction. It'll say, multiple choice. It'll say, he opens our hearts to what? His truth, his beauty, or his holiness? And it's his love. And it will say, he purifies our imaginations by his truth, by his love, or by his holiness. And he quickens us by his truth, his beauty, or his love. So you just need to get those four and four kind of matched up in your mind. And that is a definition of worship. And the final is we submit our wills to his purpose. Every time I read the Bible and worship the Lord, I say, I want to submit to what I see in your word as your purpose for my life. So that is an important page, okay? Now, look at pages 11 and 12. You can just look at that. This is a summary on page 11 and 12 of all the different beautiful, worshipful names of Jesus. And now, exactly 31 minutes late, I'm in hour two, so you ought to see how fast we're going to go now, okay? I told one too many stories, okay? So now, get to page 13, right there. In your notes, fill in the blanks. And what I'm going to give you is an overview of the end of days in Revelation. If you have your Bibles, do you guys still carry clunky paper ones? Anybody? Oh, good, good. Go to chapter 6, and I want to show you something real quick, actually from the Bible. And this is, instead of just reading these notes, chapter 6 starts the judgments, and from the moment the climactic return of the king comes through chapter 19, there is a river of God's wrath flooding the earth. We begin in chapter 6 with the Lord beginning to unroll seven seals. Look at verse 1. I saw the Lamb, that's in chapter 5, he's introduced, opening one of the seals. So the whole book of Revelation is predicated on this roll of paper towel-like seal. It's a scroll was like a roll of paper towel, and it had seals that so you could only open the roll of paper towel so far till it was sealed. And then one by one, the seals and more of the scroll gets opened. So sometime if you ever see, you know, a bounty or brawny roll on the counter, unroll it and then think of sealing it so that people can't unroll it. That's what you're seeing. It's a Roman message that you had security clearance. And you could only, you know, in that world, you would read until there was a seal, and then it went to someone else who had authority to break the seal, and you'd see more of it and read more of the message. That's what it's like. Look at verse 12. That's the sixth seal in chapter 6. There's an earthquake. God makes the earth shake. The sun becomes black. All of these scenes flash by. What we're looking at, and I call it a global horror movie. The verses 15 to 17 in chapter 6, can you imagine it? After that earthquake, the shaken inhabitants of earth scream for the rocks and mountains to fall on them. People are so scared in the tribulation, they're hoping that they'll die. It's kind of like, have you ever been in a dream that's so awful you shake and wake yourself up because you don't want any more of it? It was so bad. That's what the whole world's going to be, only they can't. And that's only chapter 6. There are 14 more chapters like that. Because if you look at Revelation 8:1, 8:1 is the last seal. That seal unleashes 7 trumpet judgments. It's almost like those, have you ever seen those Russian Matryoshka dolls that you have this big fat one, you take it off, and there's a littler fat one. Then you take that off, and inside there are just more of them getting down to this little eeny teeny weeny one that's in there. Each of the seals opens another one, and the last seal opens the trumpets, and the last trumpet opens the bowls. And it's almost like accordion. You know, you're getting deeper in, but each one gets worse. It's really unbelievable the way God does it. It's a global horror movie. But Revelation 6, 7, and 8 is only a preview of how bad it is. It's the trailer. By the time we get to chapter 9, verse 1, if you look there, the fifth angel sounded, and he's given a key to the bottomless pit. Did you know that on earth there is a place that God has incarcerated the worst creatures ever created in the universe? They're here, but they're in confinement. And you know, every time there are like Warcraft and I don't even know all these horrible video games, but the names of the creatures in there kind of parallel the Bible. Abaddon, Destroyer, and all these things. Those are demons. And we'll look at them in just a moment. But when the real horror is unleashed is in verse 3 of chapter 9. These demons get out, sweep across the world like locust, a cloud of them screeching overhead, and it envelops the earth. And what's amazing about these things is that walls don't stop them, glass doesn't stop them. You know, at least on Independence Day, all those monsters were stopped by the glass until they broke it. These things go through. They are non-material beings. Do you know what a demon is? The word demon in Greek, daimon, is the word intelligence. A demon is an intelligent spirit that is thousands of years old and is super powerful and used to be one of God's angels and fell into the rebellion and became a fallen angel or a demon. That's when the real horror is unleashed. And the greatest massacre alive, so if you look at verse 10 of chapter 9, for 150 days, the world has something to fear. They've only had searing pain up until chapter 9, verse 9, but now horrific death comes, and by Revelation 9, 17, a third of all humans on earth are killed. Unbelievable. That's a fire that begins to melt the whole universe. And basically, if you want to see something, look at Revelation 20, starting in verse 7. It says, the 1,000 years were expired, Satan is released, he deceives, verse 8, Gog and Magog. Verse 9, they go the breadth of the earth. And look at the end of verse 9, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured. Remember I said he incinerates? That's the beginning of a fire that's going to melt. Did you know that God melts everything? It starts right there. Look at the end of verse 9. Fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Now this isn't my book, but you know, can you back up a sec? Don't tell them we went there. Look at 2 Peter 3, because I teach this in other places, but they don't let me teach it here. But look at 2 Peter chapter 3. It's just before, you know, it's 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Jude, Revelation. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be what? What does your Bible say? What does it say in the end of verse 10? Yeah, everybody read the last two words and say it out loud. The whole, what does it say? The earth and the works that are in it. Wow, everything. And by the way, it starts out in verse 10, it says the heavens are going to pass away with a loud sound and the earth's going to melt. So that's really bad. That's a fire that God constitutes, that he launches, that burns up the whole universe. That means everything is consumed. But here's the application. That's why I wanted to bring you to verse 11. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of people ought you to be in what? What is the last part of verse 11? Someone with a good outdoor voice, read verse 11, the second half for us. There we go. Good. You read the whole thing. It's so good. In lives of, thank you, of holiness and godliness. Do you remember I asked you a moment ago, how many of you thought about holiness this morning when you got up? How many of you really said, God, you are holy, and only those who follow after holiness ever get to see you, and so I want your kingdom to come in my life, and I want to live a holy life. I know that I'm fallen and imperfect and have all kinds of struggles, and I know I'm going to take steps away from you, but as soon as I do, I'm going to take that one step back of repentance. And I get right back to where I'm supposed to be. The verse that, by the way, what's your name there? Matt, that Matt just read, that we ought to be thinking about holy conduct every day. Do you guys think about holy conduct every day or about what you're wearing? Do you think about holy conduct every day or what your hair looks like? See, I have a little up on you. I don't have to worry about my hair. My entire prep is this. I'll show it to you. How do you like that? Got my hair done. I've totally worked it over. No, but you know what I mean. We get so caught up in what our shoes look like and what our clothes look like, and we get caught up with how tanned we are if you're into that, or how thin we are if you're into that. And God says, don't you realize everything you see is going to be destroyed? And so basically what he's saying is this. Everything unconnected to God burns up. I meet people. I mean, I just sat for about, oh, I'll tell you. I could tell you so many stories. Because I'm a pastor. All I do is work with people. I work 50-plus hours a week, and they pay me to spend 25 hours studying the Bible. I've been paid to study the Bible 25 hours a week for almost 40 years. 25 hours a week times 52 weeks is 1,300 hours. I have studied the Bible for about 50,000 hours. The Bible. It's a lot of time. That's a lot of years of my life. But the other side is I get to spend 25 hours a week with people. Right now I have 10 small groups of men that I meet with every week. We study the Bible. We're studying the 52 greatest chapters in the Bible, I call it. That's this year's study. And I take them on a survey of the whole Bible, showing the 52 greatest key chapters in the Bible. I was speaking at a conference like this, and I mentioned that, and it was all veterinarians, doctors. It was just this high-level Chicago conference of bigwigs is what it was, and rich people. And men lined up at the end of the conference. I think their wives made them. And they came and they said, my wife said that she wants me to lead a Bible study in our family, and I don't know what to do. Could you show me how? And I said, oh, I'd love to. And so I gave him some tips and pointers. And there's one man that kept getting at the end of the line. He was older. And he kept going to the end of the line. And finally, the last one of these people, and he was there. And I said, you keep going to the end. He said, well, I want to be last. I said, okay, how can I help you? He said, could you go and sit over there on that bench with me? I said, I can go over and sit on the bench. So I went over and sat on the bench at this conference center. And he said, I have a company on four continents. He said, I have 26,000 employees. He said, I have homes all over the world. He said, I fly between them. He said, I never carry a suitcase. He said, I have a complete set of everything everywhere in the world, and I just get on the plane with my iPhone. And he said, I fly to my other house. And he said, I work my business all over the world. He said, last year I sold $27 billion. He said, it's a family-owned business, and we did $27 billion last year. I said, oh, yeah. I said, kind of like what I would tell you about my life, too. You know, I said, we're very similar. And he smiled at me and he said, we're not similar. He said, I'm a Christian. I have four sons. He said, I've never discipled them. He said, and now they're taking over my multi-billion-dollar global company. And he said, I feel like I've never talked to them about God. He said, I think they're Christians, but he said, that's it. And I said, so you want me to pray for you? He said, no. He said, I will fly once a month to wherever you are if you will teach me for an hour how to understand and communicate the Bible. I said, what do you mean? He said, I will come from wherever I am and meet you if you tell me where you are once a month. I said, okay. I said, well, in 1 month, on this day, I'll be at Starbucks. I didn't think he'd come. He walked in. He was 2 minutes late. I said, where'd you come from? He said, Singapore. He said, I had some bad connections. I'm sorry, I'm a few minutes late. I couldn't believe. He came from Singapore. He sat there with his Bible, with his notebook, and he said, I have everything that the world has to offer. He has a lot more jewels than whatever Kardashian lost. He said, what I don't have is stuff connected to God. And he said, everything I've spent my life building is going to burn up. He says, I'm on overdrive to catch up and get to know God. Are you like that? Not rich. Are you connecting as much as possible of your life to God? And we've had a great study. We've been doing it for a year. The Bible is filled with predictive verses, many, many predictive verses. I'm going to cover those in the days ahead. There are many different views of when the tribulation is. You've heard of the pre-trib view, the mid-trib, the post-trib. There are so many things that God wants us to know. But let's go to page 13 in your notes. And that's the inexplicable mystery. That's the mystery that God has kept his wrath back all this time. And basically, what we see is the unfolding of the horrors of Christ's wrath. And if you're in your notes, you can see all those seals I just talked about. The first seal, I'm right there on page 14, is the conqueror and the conflict on earth and all of that. By the way, this conqueror is the Antichrist. The conflict on earth is that we're going to go right into global warfare. Scarcity on earth, there's going to be in verse 5 and 6 of chapter 6, the third seal is going to be horrible. It's kind of what everyone in Aleppo is doing. I teach at the Amman Jordan Seminary. It's called the Jordanian Evangelical Theological Seminary. I teach there occasionally. And we have students, they only have Arabic-speaking Christians that go to the seminary, who are from all the Arab-speaking Muslim countries. They're church planters. Most people don't realize they're actually people planting churches where all those terrorists live. And they actually are paying great price. But right now, some of the students I have taught are in Aleppo. Have any of you been watching what's going on in Aleppo? How many even know what Aleppo is? You know, Aleppo is the commercial headquarters of Syria and the largest city. And it's being besieged by ISIS, by rebels, and by the Russians. And it's just unbelievable. 2 million people are trapped in there. I get one of my students, I don't know how they still have email, but he sent me an email and he says, pray for me. He said, they're barrel bombing the city. And a barrel bomb is a helicopter that drops a 55-gallon drum of explosives, and when the explosives hit, a 55-gallon drum of explosives can bring down a normal 3- or 4-story apartment building. It's such a concussive blast, it collapses the thing. And he says, we have learned, kind of like you count how many seconds after the flash of lightning to know how far away the thunder is, we have learned when we see that flash of the barrel bomb exploding, we count the seconds, and we know how far away they're bombing all the apartments. I thought, why don't you just leave? And then the next line says, we can't leave. They've hemmed the city, and we're all trapped here. But he said, pray for me, because the church meets in my apartment. And he says, I've been counting the seconds, and they're on our street blowing up the apartment buildings. But he said, we don't have telephone, so everybody's coming here for the service. So he said, pray that the Lord lets us gather and they don't drop a barrel bomb on us. We know nothing about what it's like in the tribulation, but look at the news reports of Aleppo. That's a small taste of the horrors the whole world's going to go through. Well, basically, the book of Revelation, where we're covering, are the chilling words of God's warning for what he's going to do to this world. And what he's going to do is, they're going to be confronted with, your next fill in the blank is inescapable death. And the chilling words of God's warning come to the inescapable death. But you can see, if you look in your notes right under what you just typed, inescapable death, it's appointed for men once to die, and after that, the judgment. No one dies a moment early or a moment late. We all have an appointment with death. And so what the Lord does for us is he has already given us what I call a tour of the grave, and that's on the bottom of page 17. And one of the, and I, if I was teaching Luke, I would take you all through this, but since I'm not, it's in your notes. Jesus let the disciples in this story about the rich man and Lazarus see what's going on in the grave. And I'll tell you what, the grave is horrible, and you can read that for yourself. And the bottom line is this. Life is fragile, and if you look on page 19, life is fragile. Let me get to it. Death is inevitable, and Christ is the answer. And when I was flying back, I was here last week, you know, for chapel with you guys, even though many of you don't even remember that. I saw it at the beginning of the course, but I'm teasing you. But I flew back at 5 a.m. Monday morning yesterday, started back this way, and when I landed in Chicago, all I saw were ambulances and fire trucks out on the runway at O'Hare, the second largest airport in America. And I was looking out the window and I was taking pictures, and immediately, you know what I thought about? Life is fragile. We're all a heartbeat, a brainwave, or a breath away. Death is inevitable. It's appointed unto man once to die. All of us in this room are going to die unless Christ comes before that moment of our death. But all of us, and every human, is going to die and go to what I just described for you. In fact, that part I just crossed over about the tour of the grave is fascinating. But you're all going to get to see it because you have to run your eyes over all those things because that's part of this course. But Christ is the answer. And that's what we've been charged with telling the world. Real quickly, the summary of chapter 6 is this. There are these truths. Number one, if you look in chapter 6 of Revelation, verse 1, I'm just going to go through each word of verse 1. Now I saw means that the events in Revelation are presented in one long chronological event. The book of Revelation is just a movie of what's going to happen in the future. Number two, the Lamb opened. Jesus is the central character of Revelation. It is so exciting that he gives us the guided tour of the future, and that bell's going to ring in 30 seconds. The third truth is one of the seals means God bases all the tribulation judgments on this roll of paper towel. You know, that's what I call the scroll. It's just like a long scroll. It's the title deed to the universe that Jesus is conquering back and saying, I'm the creator, and you've got to submit to me. Truth four, John personally witnessed these events. Do you realize John got to go into the future? John wasn't seeing what's going to happen. John was seeing it happen. And when you get back from break, I will explain how that's possible in physics.